When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
All engine running. Absolute genius.
Get this.
Welcome.
This is the show where we bring you
science.
What that essentially means is
discovery,
advances,
questions,
research,
technology.
Unbelievable.
Without further ado,
this is The Naked Scientists.
Hello and welcome to The Naked Scientists, the show where we bring you the latest breakthroughs in science, technology and medicine with me, James Titko. Coming up.
This isn't something we're worried is going to happen. It's already here. So Scotland has the highest rate of drug-related deaths in Europe and one of the highest in the world. And in England, Wales and Northern Ireland, rates of drug-related deaths have increased by about 60% over the last decade.
We're going to be finding out why public health officials are so concerned about powerful new synthetic opioids, many times stronger than heroin, making their way into the UK drugs market.
From Cambridge University's Institute of Continuing Education, this is The Naked Scientists.
The National Crime Agency has expressed its concern over new extremely potent drugs that it says are behind more than 100 deaths in the UK. These synthetic opioids, called nitazenes, are produced in illicit labs, unlike the drug whose effect they mimic, heroin, which is manufactured from poppies. In response, the UK government recently brought nitazenes under the strictest controls as Class A drugs. They say it will help act as a deterrent for those who may use these dangerous substances, but critics say this approach, a continuation of the so-called war on drugs, is unlikely to reverse the worrying upwards trend in drug-related deaths. To begin our investigation of this issue, I spoke with Peter Furlong, who works for Change Grow Live, a charity which helps people with drug addiction.
There's many reasons, really, as we know, that people have a relationship with illicit drugs or even prescription drugs. A lot of the time it's to cope with a lifestyle or trauma from early childhood that is being unresolved. It might be actually a lifestyle choice. People use drugs to maximise the pleasure they get from drugs. And some people may use drugs, you know, as part of a recreational pattern as well. Alternatively, it could be, you know, dependent use. So there's many reasons, really, we find that people have a relationship with drugs.
In terms of what sorts of drugs people you work with are most commonly using and which ones are doing the most harm, could you break that down for me?
Yeah, so, I mean, typically it's your opiate drugs that'll do the most harm in terms of illicit use. I mean, alcohol is the biggest killer in the UK in terms of deaths. But if we're talking about illicit use, illicit drugs, it tends to be opiates and heroin predominantly we're talking about.
It must be really difficult when, despite the work you do, there are cases when someone who you've helped who has a harmful relationship with heroin or other opiates ends up really hurting themselves.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the number of drug-related deaths now are the highest they've ever been since records began in the 90s. Just under 5,000 people a year now dying from drug-related deaths. So that's the ultimate harm, isn't it? Every death is a devastation for a number of people, for a family. It is a life that's lost. And many times preventable deaths, preventable if you know, interventions could have been offered and support.
Synthetic opioids are becoming more prevalent on the UK drug market. Is that a big worry for the vulnerable people you work with? You mentioned opiates already, and these new synthetic opioids can be even stronger and more dangerous.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's a really worrying time in the UK at the moment. We sort of seen it. Originally, it was about 2021. We first sort of experienced the synthetics in the illicit supply. Then it sort of disappeared for a little bit. But last year, come back with a vengeance, really. We've seen a lot of drug-related deaths, overdose deaths last year. And this year, we're seeing a lot more non-fatal overdose deaths that have been involved in synthetics, primarily nitazenes, which is a synthetic opiate that's being introduced to the illicit supply.
A worrying picture presented there by Peter Furlong at Change Grow Live, and one potentially that's going to get a lot worse with these new nitazenes that are coming onto the market. So what exactly are they? Well, Rick Lyons can help us here. He's the head of substance misuse at Public Health Wales and Wedanos, which is the biggest public drug testing service in the UK.
Nitazenes are a group of substances. They're a class of high-potency synthetic opioids. They were originally developed by the pharmaceutical industry in the 1950s as analgesics, you know, painkillers. But the clinical development of nitazenes was abandoned because of concerns of adverse effects and harm related to them. So they are an illicit form of substance, and again, a high potency substitute for traditional opiates.
Why are synthetic opioids so dangerous to those who use them?
Well, quite simply, because they are much more potent than the traditional opiates that they are used to substitute for. When people might be purchasing a substance, thinking it is heroin again, for example, and in reality be purchasing something that has a much more potent form of synthetic opiate mixed in. So people's breathing, for example, gets incredibly shallow. So it's usually linked, although not always, but usually linked to some form of respiratory system suppression.
Nitazenes refers to a number of different drugs. They're illegal, as you mentioned. Given these facts, how do you investigate, or how does one go about investigating the prevalence of them in the UK drug supply?
It's very difficult. I mean, probably the most effective way of doing it is obviously to have access to drug checking or drug testing. And we're fortunate that we have the Wedanos program here in Wales that is able to do some of that. And there are other sort of smaller projects in England, and they're looking to start one up in Scotland. But it's very, very difficult. We're talking about very tiny doses. And we accept samples from a range of both partner agencies out in the community, from drug services, from nighttime economy venues, from prison services, from accident and emergency, from homeless hostels and shelters, etc. And we also accept anonymous submissions from the public. They can send in a sample of what they've purchased. Wedanos works from the perspective that the only way to be 100% sure of your own safety is not to take a substance. But if you are going to take a substance, it obviously increases your safety, decreases your risk of harm to know what you're taking.
And as per your work, what's the scale of the nitazene problem here in the UK?
Wedanos, as a service, does not test overall prevalence. It's a voluntary service, so we're only able to test what is submitted to us. In terms of nitazenes, we received our first sample of a nitazene in April of 2021, so about 3 years ago. And initially, for the first sort of period of time, we mainly saw nitazenes in samples that were submitted as oxycodone. Leading up to the Christmas period, we were detecting nitazenes in quite a lot of samples that were being sent to us as benzodiazepines, counterfeit pharmaceutical products, essentially, that probably being purchased from illicit online pharmacies. And again, this was a concern because you wouldn't necessarily expect to see a synthetic opiate in a benzodiazepine product. They're different substances with different effects. And it sort of raised concerns of nitazenes kind of encroaching outside of the opiate market into other substances. Although keep in mind that the substances that we have submitted to us, nitazenes are quite a small percentage, probably about 2 or 3%. But clearly we have seen an increase in the number of submissions that contain nitazenes. Now, whether that's because they're increasingly prevalent in the market or whether there is an increased awareness about nitazenes and an increased concern about nitazenes, which is causing more people to send in substances, we don't know.
Many thanks to Rick Lyons from Wedanos there. Now, one of the reasons nitazenes are of real concern here in the UK is because of the staggering scale of the synthetic opioid crisis that has gripped North America in recent years. Opioids were responsible for 80,000 overdose deaths in 2021 in the United States, and officials are worried a similar surge could be on the way here too. Adam Holland is a public health consultant and an expert on drugs and policy at the University of Bristol. He recently published an article in The Lancet about the UK's looming drug death problem.
We can't just compare the UK and the US. We don't know the same thing is going to happen here. There are different social factors. We're obviously situated geographically differently, and we have different types of drugs through different routes coming into our countries. But a lot of people are worried that that big surge in deaths in 2013 related to one of the other types of synthetic opioids, fentanyl. We might see similar here with nitazenes.
These synthetic opioids, they present particular advantages to producers and suppliers of illegal drugs.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think one way of looking at this that some people have argued is this is kind of inevitable, particularly in the context in which we have with drug policy, we have prohibition and we try and stop the trade of drugs. It is in the benefits of producers responding to those policies to produce drugs that are synthetic. So they don't require a large amount of crops. They can be produced in clandestine laboratories underground, which are very difficult to find. And because they're more potent, a smaller quantity of the drug is needed for the same size of market. So it's easier to transport and it's easier to smuggle. At the moment, we're seeing some concerning changes in the heroin market internationally. So in 2022, the Taliban in Afghanistan prohibited the cultivation of poppies. And poppies in Afghanistan are used to produce most of the heroin that is traded in Europe. It's possible production might move to other areas, but the worst case scenario, and something that everyone's very worried about, is that we're going to see a massive decrease in the amount of heroin that is being produced. And that gap in the market is going to be filled by these more potent synthetic drugs like nitazenes.
Conversation at the moment is centered on nitazenes and fentanyl, but given all the advantages synthetic opioids have for producers, is there the potential for more lab-made drugs to make their way onto the market in the future? By classifying nitazenes as Class A, as the UK government did recently, is nitazenes today, but it could be something else tomorrow?
Yeah, again, I think that's exactly right. So we don't know what's next, and nitazenes probably aren't going to be the end of the story. So since the late 1990s, nearly 900 new novel substances have been detected in circulation in Europe. Nitazenes are the latest that are causing an issue. We don't know what direction this is going to go. In terms of the classification, I don't think that classifying nitazenes as Class A is going to help. So nitazenes were already controlled under a piece of legislation called the Psychoactive Substances Act. Now, under that act, the production and supply of drugs is criminalized, but not the possession of drugs. So what moving those drugs under control in the Misuse of Drugs Act does is it criminalizes the possession of those drugs, the people who are using them. Most people using nitazenes aren't aware that they are in possession of them. They're not intending to use them. So it's not clear that that's going to act as a deterrent. We also know that criminalization of possession causes a huge amount of harm to potentially quite vulnerable people. It might exacerbate the factors that have led those people to have harmful relationships to drugs in the first place. But the worst case scenario is this is like cutting off the head of Hydra. So you cut one head off and then two more heads are going to appear as people are branching out into other drugs, as we're potentially making it a bit more difficult to produce these specific drugs at the moment.
That was Adam Holland from the University of Bristol. You're listening to The Naked Scientists with me, James Titko. Still to come, we'll ask what policymakers should be doing to tackle synthetic opioids like nitazenes. First, though, we're going to explore some of the proposals that could potentially make things safer for drug users. The UK's first drug consumption room is set to open in Glasgow this summer in a bid to drive down drug deaths in Scotland. There have also been calls to allow drugs to be checked at places like nightclubs and music festivals, and health professionals would like a medication called naloxone to be more readily available in a bid to block the powerful effects of opioids. Now, all these interventions come under the umbrella of harm reduction. The guiding principle is that, for better or worse, People are going to use drugs for a variety of reasons, of which Peter gave us a sample earlier. So giving people the ability to make the process safer will reduce harm. Opponents of these strategies, however, question whether this encourages illicit drug use. Guy Jones is a senior scientist at The Loop, which supports free drug testing services. I caught up with him here in Cambridge to hear about drug testing, other harm reduction strategies, and the work he's doing to make drugs safer for those who choose to use them.
So the idea behind a drug checking service is twofold. One is, of course, to identify the drug and give information about the concentration, about the strength of that drug, to help somebody to manage the amount that they consume and to mitigate the risk from that. In many cases, what we actually find is that when we tell people this is not the drug that you expect, this is a different drug with very different risks, they will simply decide that they don't want to have anything to do with this. And so we offer a secure disposal service along with the drug checking service. The other aspect of a drug checking service that's extremely important is the fact that, as well as giving this information, the person using the service is able to come into contact with a drugs professional who will be an expert and has really significant amount of knowledge about these substances, and is able to talk to the person in a non-judgmental way and simply give them information, even if they've got the right drug, about the risks that the person may not have recognised, because the level of drug education that people receive about these is often quite limited. And so by being able to give really detailed information about, okay, well, did you know that there's an interaction with this medication that you said that you take? Did you know that there's an interaction with this other drug that you're planning to consume? We can help further reduce the risk above and beyond what you can do by simply telling people this is the name of the drug and this is the concentration that it's present at.
And practically, in terms of how drugs testing is carried out, do you need to take these samples to a laboratory? Can this be done quite cheaply?
So a person comes to us with their substance of concern and they place that into a secure deposit box and they write a little bit of information about that substance of concern onto a form. We then take it through to our laboratory, which is on site, the same site. We've got one operating in Bristol at the moment. We run it through a number of different lab tests to identify what it is, the concentration, whether or not, especially importantly, is there anything that's unexpected that is present. That process takes between 20 and 60 minutes, depending on what the substance is. Service user then comes back. We ask them to come back after an hour. So the turnaround is really, really quick. And this is quite important for a drug checking service, because if you're saying, look, we can't give you any information about this for 21 days, then the opportunity to reduce the harm associated with that may be long gone because it may have been consumed.
It's taken us an awfully long time to talk about in our overall program we're making here, the role of naloxone in abating a lot of the drug deaths from synthetic opioids. What is it and how does it work?
So naloxone is an incredibly valuable drug and an incredibly simple drug in the way that it works. Effectively, when naloxone is injected into somebody or given as a nasal spray to somebody who is experiencing an opioid overdose, the naloxone molecules go into the brain and they kick off the opioid molecules and occupy the space where those opioid molecules want to be. This means that the effects of the opioid come to a halt, and any respiratory depression that the person is experiencing, which is very often the fatal component of an opioid overdose, is ended. It's an incredibly safe drug, so you can't overdose on the opioid reversal medication. So this is a really, really valuable tool. If a volunteer sees somebody who has gone over into an overdose, they can administer naloxone, and that will reverse the effects of that overdose and cause them to start breathing again.
The effectiveness of naloxone makes it one of the critical components of another harm reduction strategy alongside drugs testing, which is these safe consumption sites, things that have proven quite successful in America. Can you explain what they are, please?
The idea behind this is that it's a clinic space which is staffed with healthcare professionals where people who especially people who don't have a safe space to consume their drugs, can go and consume those drugs under the supervision of a medical professional. And the idea behind it is that if they run into a situation where they overdose, then they can receive immediate medical attention to address that. It also gives the advantage that it puts these people, who in many cases are extremely vulnerable, into regular contact with a healthcare professional. So on the day that they wake up and they're feeling good about themselves, they're feeling strong, and they think, you know what, I'm ready to make some changes. On that day, they are also in contact with a healthcare professional.
You're mainly involved with drugs testing, as we've discussed. Do you get any public money for this?
So the Loop doesn't receive any funding from the government. We're an organisation that is almost exclusively staffed by volunteers, so that helps to keep the costs down.
Given the popularity of these harm reduction strategies amongst many healthcare professionals, it seems like a bit of a missed opportunity to not be funding them. I'm sure I know what you're going to say as an answer to that, but I'll put it to you anyway.
It's challenging, right? I understand totally, as a, you know, as a government, as politicians, you need to keep the public on side. And if a person is not au fait with the medical evidence and the scientific evidence behind how effective these interventions are, then they may react more emotionally and feel that it's not appropriate to help somebody who's experiencing drug addiction. Many people think that, well, they just need a tough love approach, and therefore it's better to let them suffer and hope that they reach rock bottom and then they'll just turn it around themselves. But practically speaking, while that does work for some people, it certainly doesn't work for a lot of people. And the medical evidence suggests that it leads to a vastly increased cost in terms of the amount of healthcare that people need, and it increases the number of deaths that are experienced by people who are brothers, sisters, children, parents of other people. You know, these are people's loved ones, and if the cost of a strategy is, well, we have to let a lot of people die to teach the other people a lesson, then that's not necessarily going to be an effective strategy.
That was Guy Jones from The Loop. Finally then, to consider what policymakers should be doing to get on top of this problem, we thought it pertinent to speak with David Nutt, Chair of Drug Science and one-time Chief Drug Advisor to the UK government. I began by asking him whether incredibly powerful drugs, such as nitazenes, should be banned.
I think it makes sense in that potent opiates, which aren't used medically, should be controlled in some way to at least allow governments to seriously prosecute people who are caught dealing them. Whether it'll have any impact on importation or use is yet to be seen, but it's consistent with the current policy. It would be not really sensible to have these drugs widely available because they are very dangerous.
There have been a small number of deaths directly affiliated with these drugs, but some public health officials have criticise the tracking system when it comes to the spread of them here in the UK. What are the problems? Is it by virtue of the fact that they're so new?
Well, there are several problems. The first is we don't have any kind of joined up science in the coroner system. So if coroners don't know these drugs exist, then why are they going to ask for them to be tested for? So the first thing we need to do is make sure that all unexplained deaths are tested for a range of drugs, not just nitazenes, but also fentanyls, and ideally, you know, other drugs which can kill you. So even maybe synthetic cannabinoids. The second thing is it takes several years before a drug death gets to the coroners. And that really is absolutely inexcusable. We should have a system where at least the toxicology is done almost immediately. And if new drugs are found, they should be communicated to all coroners and also to the public health system straight away. And thirdly, and this, I think, is the most important one for this current episode, we need to have testing facilities available so that people can test what they have, particularly if they've taken something which has produced an effect which they weren't expecting. And again, that should feed in to the public health system. The Dutch have been doing this for nearly 30 years. It works. We still are hooked on this idea that if you scare people about drugs, they'll stop using them. Well, we know that's not the case, so let's change our attitude and be more adult about this.
Some say we've opened Pandora's box when it comes to synthetic opioids. It's fentanyl and nitazenes today, but because of the advantages these drugs pose to producers and that they can be made in clandestine labs and, you know, the ingenuity of chemists, nefarious or otherwise, it could be something entirely different tomorrow.
Yes, which is why we have to test and why we have to have very high level of surveillance. But let me just say a couple of words about the opening of the box. We didn't open the box particularly. The Americans opened the box. They opened the box by having an extraordinary overreaction to their prescribed opiate crisis, which then led to the rise of fentanyls. And we're basically catching a cold as America sneezes. Fentanyl exists simply because there's not enough heroin. Luckily, in Britain, we're one of the very few countries in the world in which heroin is a medicine. We can actually make heroin available to opiate users legally, and that would be a great way of stopping them going to fentanyls.
I wonder if you could explain the thinking behind why that's a good idea.
The problem with criminalizing drug users is that once they have a criminal record, it effectively excludes them from most employment. So they naturally turn to dealing drugs, and that creates the market. And we know that. We know that in 1971, there were about 1,000 heroin addicts in Britain who were getting prescribed heroin. It was called the British system, and it was the envy of the world. And then we decided to stop prescribing heroin, and we went from 1,000 in 1971 to 200,000 by 1990. So allowing access to heroin is the way to stop people making others addicted to heroin. And that, so decriminalization and getting people into treatment is way the most efficient way of stopping the expansion or the rollout of opiate use.
As a proponent of this drug policy, what have you made of what's been happening in Oregon and in Vancouver, where they've tried this? They've had extended periods of a year or 3 years, respectively, where they've brought in a decriminalization of the possession of small amounts of these drugs. But deaths are still, they're not accelerating in how fast they're increasing, as opposed to before this policy was introduced, but they're still increasing. And in both of the cases I've mentioned, they're looking at watering down their approach.
Well, we'll certainly find out what happens if they do that. I mean, prediction is things will get worse. The problem, I think, with both the US and the Canadian system is that they don't have a proper safety net of treatment. I mean, if you look at, for instance, Portugal and the Netherlands, there's two countries where they've had a very different policy on the use of opiates. What you see there is that treating people who use opiates humanely, getting them into treatment, taking them out of the criminal system, has massively reduced the harms. But that does require a joined up policy where it's not just decriminalization, it's also providing the whole range of other infrastructures that will allow people to move out of drug use into employment. It requires prescribing drugs like methadone and buprenorphine, and to some extent, and in some cases, heroin. They didn't do that in the US and Canada. They hoped, I suppose, to see if they could get some benefit without investing. It hasn't worked as well as it could.
That was David Nutt. And speaking of political will, we asked the Home Office to respond to the issues that have been raised throughout the course of this programme. They sent us a statement from the Home Secretary, James Cleverly, which says, "We are highly alert to the threat from synthetic drugs and have been taking a range of preventative action, learning from experiences around the globe, to keep these vile drugs off our streets. Our plan is working. The overall quantities of synthetic opioids reaching the UK remain lower than other countries, but we are not complacent. Placing these toxic drugs under the strictest controls sends a clear message that the consequences for peddling them will be severe." That's it for this week. Join us next time when Will Tingle will take a closer look at the impact of climate change on food production. Can we reconcile an increasing demand for food and curb global warming? The Naked Scientists comes to you from the University of Cambridge's Institute of Continuing Education. It's supported by Rolls-Royce. I'm James Titko, and from everyone here at The Naked Scientists, thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.